Dog, and this is VOA Weather Hits.
Welcome to Learning English on the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. Our 30-minute program of news and information is designed especially for English learners. We speak slowly, using simple grammar and a limited vocabulary. On the show today, we have a report from Mario Ritter. We also hear our American history program, The Making of a Nation. But first, diamonds, sunglasses, and sports clothing can be made using carbon dioxide, or CO2, one of the major gases causing the Earth's atmosphere to warm. Young technology companies making such manufacturing possible are getting attention from investors. Some manufacturing methods use bacteria. Others use proteins. Some use chemical processes to speed natural reactions. Most separate the carbon and oxygen in CO2 to create another chemical that is used to make popular products. It is estimated that these companies have raised over $800 million so far this year. That is more than three times their 2020 total, reports Reuters. The news agency examined data from research companies PitchBook, Circular Carbon Network, CleanTech Group, and ClimateTech VC. I don't want to call it a green tax, but our consumers, who really do care, have demonstrated that they're willing to pay a bit of a premium, said Ryan Shearman. He is chief of Ether Diamonds, which uses captured CO2 to manufacture diamonds. Another use of recycled carbon is less shiny, but still strong, concrete. Carbon Cure Technologies is developing a method that injects CO2 into fresh concrete. The trapped carbon strengthens the concrete and keeps the gas out of the air. Robin Niven leads the company. He said the word green is good for marketing products. About 90% of our uptake has been from independent concrete producers, large and small, that are just looking for that competitive edge. The United Nations says countries need to capture and store 10 billion tons of CO2 every year by 2050 to slow climate change. Current carbon capture programs, however, can only store thousands of tons. Humans produce heat-trapping gases equal to around 50 billion tons of CO2 each year. International officials will gather in Scotland in late October and November for a UN climate conference on cutting gas emissions or releases. In May, Columbia University's Center for Global Energy Policy released a report on CO2 recycling. The report said that if all products made from oil used recycled CO2 instead, it would result in about 6.8 billion fewer tons of carbon emissions. Amar Bardwaj was the lead writer. He said CO2 recycling is not always the best choice. He said that trying to reduce carbon emission only with recycling would be a misuse of CO2 recycling because there are less costly methods. Nicholas Flanders is a co-founder of a company called 12. It uses chemical processes to reuse CO2. Flanders said recycling is better than storing captured CO2 underground. We're developing a technology that can go toe-to-toe with fossil fuels, he said. He added that his company can remove carbon without seeking financial support from the government. That is because many consumers are interested in the green message of carbon recycling. Clothing company Lululemon Athletica says it has created a polyester material from carbon emissions jointly with LanzaTech. That company uses bacteria to recycle ethanol, a kind of alcohol, into ethylene. Ethylene is used to make polyester cloth and plastic containers. LanzaTech has raised the most money of the companies competing in the field, the Reuters examination found. CEO Jennifer Holmgren said LanzaTech's ethanol costs more than ethanol made from corn. But people who want green products are buying anyway. The biggest investment in the new market this year, more than $350 million, went to Soligen, a company based in Houston, Texas. Soligen feeds CO2 and other things to enzymes that make chemicals for stronger cement, water pipe coatings, and other products. Its products already cost less than those made from fossil fuels, said Soligen chief Gaurab Chakrabarty. The company does not get its CO2 from factory emissions or from the air. However, Chakrabarty does describe this as an option. Capturing CO2 does not seem like a good idea to many investors, who think the government should be responsible for such high-cost, high-risk projects. However, Nicholas Moore Eisenberger of investment group Pure Energy Partners thinks differently. He invested in direct air capture company Global Thermostat. He said he sees opportunity in necessity. He believes that once the projects grow, costs will fall. The science tells us that we have under a decade to start to bend the curve on climate, and that is now within the investment time frame of most private investors, Eisenberger said.
Chile trees are rare evergreens found mainly in the South American country of Chile, and they are increasingly important to producing new vaccines. The native Mapuche people have long used them to make soap and medicine. In recent years, Chile trees, also known as Chilaya saponaria, have been used in the processing of food and drinks. They have also been used to make a highly successful vaccine against shingles, a painful viral disease, and the world's first malaria vaccine. Now, molecules extracted from the bark or outer covering of older Chile trees are being used for a COVID-19 vaccine. It is being developed by American drug maker Novavax. Over the next 2 years, Novavax plans to produce billions of treatments of the vaccine for use in developing countries. Novavax uses two molecules to make adjuvant, a substance that improves the human immune system. One of those, called QS21, is more difficult to find. The substance is found mainly in chelate trees that are at least 10 years old. British drug maker GlaxoSmithKline uses QS21 in its highly successful vaccine against shingles called Shingrix. It is also used in several other promising experimental vaccines. The chelate-based adjuvant used in Shingrix is also part of the world's first malaria vaccine, Mosquirix. Less than 1 milligram of chelate extract is required to make a vaccine treatment. But the supply of chelate is stretched by the demand from other industries. Chelate products are used as a natural additive in animal feed. They also are used to kill harmful insects and as an agent to reduce pollution in mining. Some drug makers are developing a manufactured version of QS21, but it could take years to get approval. Exchanging this substance for another in any existing vaccine would require new drug tests to prove the product is safe and effective. Jason Paragas, a vice president at drug company Agenus, said the shortage of QS21 has been an issue for a while. He added, "We saw it before COVID, and we made the hard decision that we had to change." The American company in Massachusetts stopped selling the natural version of QS21 several years ago. It now centers on trying to grow it from chelate plant cells in a laboratory. Paragas said it is too soon to know when it will be ready. Botanical Solution, a California-based company, says it can already produce QS21 from chelate seeds in the laboratory. The company adds that it aims to produce the substance in large quantities for drug companies. No one knows how many healthy chelate trees are left in Chile to meet the demand. Experts and industry officials believe that they will at some point need to switch to grow the evergreens on farms or in laboratories. Ricardo San Martin developed the pruning and extraction process that created the modern chelate industry. He said, producers must immediately work toward making chelate products from younger farm-grown trees. My estimate 4 years ago was that we were heading towards the sustainability limit, he said. Chelate producers say the harvest can continue for now without destroying the supply of older trees. Novavax told Reuters that the company is working with suppliers to make sure life-saving vaccines will be prioritized. Andres Gonzalez runs Desert King International, which operates a chelate farm in Chile. It is Novavax's only supplier and the largest chelate exporter in the country. He said it produces enough chelate extract from older trees to make up to 4.4 billion vaccine treatments in 2022. With new supplies from privately owned forests, he said, the operation can meet demand for the rest of this year and part of the next. He admitted, however, that at some point, these native forests will come to an end. Gustavo Cruz is a researcher at the University of Chile who worked with San Martin to industrialize the production of chelate. He said he generally trusts chelate producers to deal with supply and demand. He is more worried about other threats, especially a lack of water and fire. The trees do eventually regrow, he said, but there comes a time when they don't anymore. I'm Mario Ritter, Jr.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation. James Buchanan of Pennsylvania won the presidential election of 1856. He defeated John Fremont, the candidate of the newly created Republican Party, which opposed slavery. Buchanan, a Democrat, had often supported the South in the dispute over slavery. Most of the new president's closest friends were Southerners. He wrote that the North was too aggressive toward the South and should stop interfering in the slave states. Buchanan said the South had good reason to leave the Union if abolitionists continued their attacks against slavery. Jack Moyles and Stan Busby tell more about James Buchanan, and they discuss his influence in the Supreme Court ruling in the case of a slave from Missouri named Dred Scott.
As the new president, Buchanan believed he could solve the slave question by keeping the abolitionists quiet. Success would mean the end of the anti-slavery Republican Party. In choosing his cabinet, Buchanan wanted men who shared the same ideas and interests. President Pierce had tried to unite the different groups in the party by giving each a representative in his cabinet. This had not worked. It had driven the different party groups farther apart. Buchanan had served in President Polk's cabinet. He remembered how well its members worked together. He said it was the unity of this cabinet that made Polk's administration so successful.
Buchanan gave the job of Secretary of State to Lewis Cass of Michigan. Cass was 75 years old. His mind had lost its sharpness. This did not worry Buchanan, because he had planned to be his own foreign minister. The job of Treasury Secretary went to Howell Cobb, a Southern moderate from Georgia. Southerners also were named as Secretary of War, Interior Secretary, and Postmaster General. Isaac Tousey of Connecticut was given the job of Navy Secretary. Tousey was a Northerner, but he supported many policies of the South. Another Northerner, Jeremiah Black of Pennsylvania, became Attorney General. In forming his cabinet, Buchanan did not ask for advice from Senator Douglas of Illinois. Douglas was the party's leader in the Senate and the most powerful Democrat in the Northwest. Douglas believed that the Northwest should have two representatives in the cabinet. He said Cass could be one of them. But Douglas wanted one of his own supporters to be the other. Buchanan refused what Douglas wanted, and he gave the administration support to a political enemy of Douglas.
James Buchanan was sworn in as president on March 4, 1857. In his inaugural speech, the new president denounced the long dispute over slavery. He said he hoped it would end soon. Buchanan said the dispute could be settled easily by doing two things: by ending interference with slavery in states where it was legal, and by letting the people of a territory decide if they wanted slavery. Buchanan said he expected the Supreme Court to rule soon on the right of the people of a territory to decide this. He said he was sure that all good citizens, North and South, would accept the High Court's ruling.
At the time he said this, Buchanan already knew what the court's decision would be. He had even used his influence to help one member of the court to decide. The decision was made in the case of Dred Scott, a Negro slave. Scott was sold in Missouri to an army doctor who took him to Illinois and then went into the Wisconsin Territory. Scott lived in these two places for almost 4 years before he was returned to Missouri. Scott asked a court in Missouri to give him his freedom. He claimed that living in Illinois and Wisconsin, where slavery was illegal, had made him a free man.
The court agreed with Scott and gave him his freedom. But the decision was appealed, and the Supreme Court of Missouri ruled against him. Scott then took his case to a federal court. Finally, he asked the United States Supreme Court to decide if he was a slave or a free man. The Supreme Court took up the case in December 1856. The judges studied it carefully because it raised serious constitutional questions. Scott claimed he was free because he had lived in free territory. It was free because Congress, in the Missouri Compromise of 1820, made slavery illegal in that area. Scott's owner raised the question, did Congress have the constitutional power to close a territory to slavery? Was the Missouri Compromise legal?
At first, most of the 9 Supreme Court judges had planned to give a decision without answering this question. They did not want to involve the court in this bitter dispute. The majority decided that a Negro was not a citizen. Therefore, they said, Dred Scott had no right to ask the court to hear his case. In this way, the case could be settled without deciding on the power of Congress to act on slavery in the territories. But 2 of the 9 Supreme Court judges opposed this ruling. Both were from the North. They had said they would write a minority decision. They said their decision would include a statement that Congress did have power over slavery in the territories.
Since 2 members of the court had planned to offer views on this question, the other 7 decided the majority also should do so. Of the 7, 5 were from the South. They did not believe Congress had any power over territorial slavery. The remaining 2 judges, both from the North, did not want to make what they felt would be a political decision. one Southern member of the Supreme Court was James Catron, a good friend of James Buchanan. Buchanan had written to him asking when the court would act on the Dred Scott case.
Catron had answered that the court would rule soon. Then he asked for Buchanan's help in getting one of the northern members of the court to vote with the five from the south. He told the president that the country would more easily accept the court's ruling if one of the northern judges gave his support. Catron proposed that Buchanan write to Justice Robert Greer of Pennsylvania. So Buchanan wrote to Greer. He told him that a strong decision in the Dred Scott case might do much to bring peace to the country. Greer agreed. He said he would vote with the five Southerners. They would rule that the Constitution did not give Congress power over slavery in the territories. All this had happened in the few weeks before Buchanan became president.
The Supreme Court finally announced its decision just 2 days after Buchanan moved into the White House. Chief Justice Roger Taney read the decision in the small courtroom in the Capitol building. The room was crowded with congressmen, senators, government officials, and newspapermen. Chief Justice Taney began reading the decision at 11 o'clock. He read for more than 2.5 hours. He said the High Court rejected Scott's claim of freedom for 3 reasons. First, Scott was not a citizen. Taney said the Constitution gave the right of citizenship only to members of the white race. Because he was not a citizen, he had no right to ask the court to hear his case. Secondly, Taney said Scott was ruled by the laws of Missouri, the state in which he lived. Missouri laws did not give freedom to slaves who lived temporarily in free territory. Therefore, said Taney, Scott was still a slave.
Then the Chief Justice took up the question of the free territory in which Scott had lived. It had become free territory under the Missouri Compromise. This was the law that Congress passed in 1820. This law kept slavery out of the northern part of the territory, which the United States bought from France. Justice Taney said Congress did not have the constitutional power to pass such a law. He said when new territory was won, it belonged to all citizens. He said Congress had the right to govern such territory until it became a state. But, he said, Congress did not have power to close new territory to any American citizen. He said the citizen from Georgia had as much right to settle in this territory with his slaves as a citizen of Maine with his horse. Taney said there was no word in the Constitution that gave Congress greater power over slave property than over any other kind of property. The only such power Congress held was the power to guard and protect the rights of the property owner. To close territory to slaves, Taney said, violated the constitutional rights of slaveholding citizens. Therefore, the Missouri Compromise was unconstitutional. Congress did not have power to act on slavery in the territories.
And that's our show. Thanks for joining us. I'm Katie Weaver.